Hello and welcome to Rock Writ. I'm your host Armin Sabajian, and we are glad you could join us for yet another exploration in rock criticism and old school fanzine culture, our 32nd such exploration for those keeping track. We have an exciting chat to share today with the one and only Andy Pearson of Fear and Loathing Fanzine. Fear and Loathing is a stalwart, is that the word they use? Stalwart British fanzine that's been going strong since 1989. It's now up to 86 issues, which is all the more amazing given the fact that Andy basically does all the work on the mag himself. I remember picking up my first copy of Fear and Loathing in the mid-90s at Full Blast Records in Toronto. I was blown away by the quality of the interviews, the mag's eclectic taste, the 7-inch records that came with it, and I continue to wonder why it's not better known among punks and underground types today. These are pretty lean times for music fanzines, so we should count ourselves lucky that this thing still exists, and it's a really quality publication. So hopefully this chat will help correct the situation even a wee bit. So please enjoy our chat with Andy Pearson of Fear and Loathing Fanzine on Rock Writ. Andy, where did you grow up? I know you've moved between London and Kent, but where did you actually grow up?
Right. Well, I lived in Canterbury, which is in Kent, southeast Kent. So I grew up there. I was there until I was about mid-20s, I think it was. That's when I first moved up to London. Canterbury was, it's a strange place. It goes through phases of either lots of stuff going on there, which seems to be happening at the moment. And then, you know, in the late 60s, they had all the kind of what's now called the Canterbury scene, which was a very sort of underground, almost psychedelic scene that was going on. That kind of died out. So unfortunately, the period when I was, you know, like a teenager, there wasn't very much going on at all, unfortunately. So eventually I ended up spending half my time traveling to and from London to see gigs and things. So that's why I eventually moved up here.
And I understand your first concert was actually a jazz show in 1970.
Technically, yeah. I still to this day don't know what happened, but my mother liked jazz. And she took me to see a musician called Acker Bilk. I don't know whether you would have ever heard of him. So certainly not something that I would, you know, ever buy a record by now. But so she took me to see this concert. And that was the first thing, like live music, I ever saw. I'm thinking the only thing that I actually remember about it was towards the end of the set, the rest of the band went off and the drummer played a solo, which was really kind of the only thing in the set that was anything more to do with like loud rock music sort of thing. It was a big drum solo. And that's the only thing I really remember about it, the noise. I'm attracted to the noise.
Well, it sounds like you were quite young, so that would probably thing that to make the impression on you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Was there, you said your mom was into jazz, was there music around the house growing up? Do you remember coming into contact with jazz or other sounds as you were a kid?
Not really. The few things that I do remember is things like old rock and roll records. My mum kind of liked that stuff as well. So she had, you know, Elvis Presley, Bill Haley, Jerry Lee Lewis, that sort of thing, which, you know, I did like because it was a bit more, I suppose, a bit faster than a lot of the pop music that was around at that time. Then I suppose during the early 70s, when I was still, you know, at my first school sort of thing, before I was like 10 years old, you know, then things would come on TV, things like, you know, glam rock stuff. That was something I really liked as well, because it seemed a bit more louder and more energy to it than regular pop music. So at home, that's really all I knew about, sort of rock and roll and glam rock.
It's interesting how many people coming up in the 70s got into punk rock initially through glam rock, right? That same kind of energy and simplicity was there. And then it was easy to connect the dots with punk and be like, oh yeah, this makes total sense to me.
Yeah. In fact, one story I've told other people about, I remember seeing Sparks on Top of the Pops, which was like the weekly music show on TV. And Sparks were doing their hit single, This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us. And I remember we were watching it, like the whole family sitting down watching it, and Sparks came on. And it was the first time my dad actually hated it. And he was ranting on, look at that, they're disgusting, they should never be allowed on TV. The keyboard player looks like Hitler, and and the singer is obviously a homosexual. You know, I'm probably about 9 years old at the time, so I'm thinking, I don't even know what a homosexual is, you know. But it was kind of, you know, it was that important moment where I suddenly thought, hey, my dad doesn't know what he's talking about with music. This sounds great. So that was quite funny, because over here, when the punk thing first happened, a lot of people, unless you were really living in London or you were a bit older, the first time you heard about punk rock was when it all hit the, you know, newspaper headlines for them swearing on TV and, you know, shocking stuff like that. So, you know, again, it's sort of like when that happened, my dad was like, oh, this is disgusting. These people should never be allowed. They, you know, should all be, you know, sent into the army and learn, you know, learn to cut their hair properly, all this sort of stuff. And, but again, you know, he hadn't actually heard the band. So, you know, what was he on about? And again, I thought, well, this is what you said about Sparks, and they were really good, so maybe this is something I should check out. You know, so his negative approach gave me more of a positive outlook on the whole thing.
That nudged you towards closer and closer to the music.
Yeah, that's it. And it sort of, I think the other occasion was also an Alice Cooper appearance on some TV show where he was doing Schools Out with, you know, with the original band. And again, my dad hated it. And again, I thought, well, if you hate this, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. So yeah, it was all kind of small things like that that gradually brought you towards what you were eventually going to be listening to.
And did you start going to punk shows at some point in the 70s? Did that become like a regular thing for you?
No. Again, due to my dad, who was very sort of strict for completely the wrong reasons, I would say. I mean, the funny thing was, he was like, right, you know, if you go to these gigs, you'll get into trouble, you'll end up taking drugs, you'll do this and that, and which never happened, obviously. But that was his view of it. So he said, you know, I'm not going to let you go to these things till you're 16. And of course, I eventually got to 16, and the first thing I did was go out and buy a ticket to go and see the Stranglers. This was in right at the beginning of 1980. And of course, the first thing he says, right, oh, if you're going to that, take your brother with you. And it's like, my brother is 2.5 years younger than me. You know, doesn't he have to wait till he's 16? But apparently not, because he could go with me. So always felt a bit miffed about that.
Do you have memories from that first Stranglers show, Andy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd already been listening to the Stranglers and had their records at that time. So actually getting to see them and, you know, it was pretty amazing, I thought. I mean, some people didn't like it because it was the period of time when they were moving away from like their more punk rock material into stuff like the Raven and the Men in Black albums. So some people didn't like that, but, you know, I, you know, it's my first concert. It's one of my favorite bands, so I thought it was great.
Do you remember when you may have picked up a fanzine or even just like a music weekly?
Yeah, the music magazines. I mean, back then there were three weekly magazines, which was Sound, Melody Maker, and New Musical Express, The Enemy. So they were, you know, even when I was going to school, you know, people would have them there, so you'd always get to see them. And I think at that point in time, it was quite good because as there were three weekly papers, they were all very competitive, you know, to, you know, outdo their competitors. And so they really made an effort to like make sure they were covering the next big thing. So, you know, you'd get to hear about all the new bands that were out there. None of them wanted to risk, you know, missing out on a band while their rivals were like covering them or something like that. So it was a lot easier to find out about smaller bands, up and coming bands and things like that. Unfortunately, at the end of the 80s, I think was when Sounds went bust and Melody Maker soon after that. So you only ended up with, you know, the NME on a weekly basis. And they could then pretty much dictate what people were going to find out about. So there wasn't, you know, by that point, it was all, you know, the bands they were covering was pretty safe, you know, bands that they knew were going to do well or whatever. So you didn't have that excitement of finding out about everything new going on, which is a bit of a shame. Mm. Now, as far as fanzines go, funnily enough, the Stranglers used to do this, their own kind of fanzine newsletter thing called Strangled, which was like a proper A4 fanzine type magazine, and they'd sell it at concerts, or you can get it by mail order. So I bought one of those at the end of the Stranglers concert. So I suppose that was, you know, the first fanzine I ever had. And obviously that was more to do about the Stranglers, but they would also, you know, the actual members of the Stranglers would sometimes interview other bands that they'd come across or write articles about them. So that was pretty cool. And I think they're all quite sort of collectible now, so you don't see them about very often.
That's so neat. I wish there was more of a tradition of bands doing fanzines themselves. That would be,
yeah.
Oh, I would have loved that.
Yeah. No, it was good because, you know, the Stranglers would write about, you know, they'd write songs about particular subjects. And then, you know, the songwriter, you know, whoever it was in the band, would actually write an article expanding on it and explaining what the song was about and what the references were. So, you know, as a Stranglers fan, it was great because then you could look into the lyrics and find out more stuff. But as I said, they would also interview people. I'm sure there was an interview with The Cure. I think The Cure had supported them at some point. So they interviewed Robert Smith from The Cure and was talking about, you know, what the band was about and their influences and everything. So again, it was like finding out what they were interested in to see if you might be interested in it as well.
There's also this, in the UK especially, I think there's this tradition of people who are using fanzines as a stepping stone to become pro music journalists. So a lot of writers for Sounds, for example, started off doing their own fanzines and then jumped off into that world.
Well, yes and no. I think originally, you know, in the late 70s, there were magazines, you know, people were doing fanzines, and if they were a decent writer, they'd get asked to write for, you know, the music weeklies. And I think that was okay because, as I said, at that time, the music press was very sort of, you know, they wanted to cover the new bands in the underground sort of thing. So, you know, obviously the fanzine writers were the best people to turn to because 9 times out of 10, they weren't really interested in the mainstream music. So they had, you know, they had ideas of what was going on in the smaller clubs and, you know, around the country. Mm-hmm. I think later on, though, it did become that sort of thing because, I mean, there's certainly a couple of people that I've come across that kind of did one or two issues of a fanzine, often very good quality, you know, like glossy paper and whatever. And they were basically using it almost like a CV to get a job in, you know, the media side of things. Mm-hmm. And you'd look at these things and you think, well, it cost me so much money, or whatever the amount was back then, to make a fanzine, and then I have to sell it at like 50p or a pound just to make my money back. So how are they producing like this really sort of high glossy magazine, selling it for a pound? And, you know, there's no way they're getting their money back because I know how much the printing costs. You know, obviously what they were doing is like, well, I'll invest some money into this to make me look good, and then I'll get a job somewhere down the line. I can gripe about that, but I mean, really, there's only a few people that I know of that kind of did that deliberately. But, you know, there were certainly people that would do that kind of thing.
You first started writing about music for a fanzine called Grim Humor. Can you talk a bit about how that came about?
Hold on. It was actually an old friend of mine, Richard, who was initiated Grim Humor. All sort of based around East Kent, as we were. I think Richard was in Herne Bay and I was in Canterbury, which are only sort of, you know, 5 or 6 miles apart. We all used to sort of know each other from going to gigs and, you know, going to the same record stores and things like that. Him and a couple of his friends started doing this fanzine. I think they did 3 issues in quite sort of short period of time. I enjoyed the reading them. And I just suggested, is there any chance I could do an interview for the fanzine? And Richard said, yeah, sure, go ahead. And not knowing at all what I was doing, really, I went to London. I was going to see the Fall play. And I just turned up at the backstage door, you know, thinking, oh, you just have to wait and see one of the band and ask them, which is what I did. And got to interview Marky Smith, which was, despite people like telling you he was a real horror to interview, I mean, he was really, really helpful. He really seemed to enjoy doing it for a fanzine. So yeah, that was the first one. Then I had to take it home and type it all up. You know, I mean, I recorded it on an old tape recorder, and then had to type it up from there, sent it in to Richard, and he was happy with it. So that got published in 1980, was it beginning? No, I did the interview at the end of 83, and it was published in early 84. But yeah, Grim Humour carried on for quite a while. I'm not exactly sure when it stopped, because I started Fear and Loathing in 1989, and Grim Humour carried on for another couple of years after that, before Richard went on to do other things. And I'd occasionally do like articles for Grim Humour as well as doing my own Fear and Loathing. So yeah, I mean, that was good. In fact, he's recently been compiling a kind of a best of Grim Humour, which has been published as like book compendiums. There's been 2 so far, and there's one more that he's working on apparently at the moment. So yeah, those are around and about if people want to check it through.
What was Grim Humour's kind of focus? You mentioned interviewing the Fall. Was it punk music, but things outside of that as well too?
Well, it's kind of strange, because genres and categories, they kind of get made up in retrospect. And at the time, you know, the stuff we were into, we just called it, oh, it's punk, you know, punk rock, that's all you needed to know. And that just meant, you know, music that we liked. And it was coming from, you know, people who were, you know, pretty much on the same level as us. You know, they were people who liked music and wanted to get out there and do something for themselves. Nowadays, I think the music that was in there would probably get called post-punk. But obviously at the time, that phrase post-punk just didn't exist. It's also one of these things that kind of, it's a bit irritating, because you get people who are kind of, well, you know, punk rock was very basic and it wasn't very great music, but then post-punk came along and that was really clever. But, you know, I mean, really, when you look at it, most of the bands were the same people. They had been, you know, 3-chord punk bands in 1977, but obviously over the next couple of years, they got better and did more interesting stuff. I mean, that's just natural. So it's kind of annoying when people go on about post-punk now, even though it's kind of, it's good in a way, because you can reference, you know, what period of time you're talking about, but really post-punk didn't exist, not in that particular point in time. But as far as the bands we were covering, I mean, it was things like, as you said, The Fall, The Damned were still really active and, you know, on the game at that time. So they were in there. There was a band called UK Decay, who we were all very enthusiastic about. They split up and then became, 3 of the members became a band called Furio, who were a great live band, but their records never really managed to capture what they were doing. Who else? Richard always had a thing about The Cure, so he covered them as much as he could. Things like The Birthday Party moving into, you know, what Nick Cave went solo. The thing that always used to bug Richard was that people would call it a goth fanzine, which wasn't really true. I mean, there were some bands which nowadays people look back at and call goth, but, you know, again, goth didn't really exist at that time. It was over the next few years that it started getting that tag to it. But you know, the bands like Sex Gang Children and the Virgin Prunes, I mean, to us it was just bands doing something new and different. It didn't really matter what they looked like, or, you know, if they were good, they were good. That's all that really concerned us.
Sounds like you guys were just unselfconscious about it. It was good music coming from that same kind of underground place. And it was eclectic.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on, and it was right across the board. So, you know, you could go and see one band and there'd be a totally different band supporting them. And, you know, maybe that band would be even better than the headliners. You just didn't know what you were going to get. And then as things developed over the next couple of years, we started to go and see bands like The Scientists, the Australian band who were living in London at that time. And they were just an amazing live band. Most of their records were really great. And then there were bands like Sonic Youth started coming over in the mid to late 80s, and Butthole Surfers, Big Black, those kind of bands. And again, it was kind of punk rock or hardcore, but done in a different way. So it kept it all interesting.
And when did you decide to start Fear and Loathing, Eddie?
Well, the first issue was in 1989. I think the reason was Richard had got more into sort of the more sort of avant-garde kind of music. And I was still listening to a lot of bands that he didn't really have much interest in, or, you know, maybe once had interest in them, but, you know, decided he wasn't going to cover anymore. So there was things like bands I wanted to interview that he didn't particularly want to have in Grim Humour. So that's why I thought, well, I'll start doing this on my own, and then I can cover whatever I want. And it, you know, and also, as I said earlier, I still would do a few sort of like bits and pieces for Grim Humour as well. So, you know, those were side by side for first couple of years, I think, and then until Richard started going off, and he ended up running a music label, a record label, which he still does to this day. So he stopped doing the magazine, at least on a regular basis. So that's why Fear and Loathing started up.
What were the earliest issues like?
Fairly basic. I mean, by that point, I'd done enough interviews so that, you know, I could put a decent interview together. I wouldn't say I was brilliant, but... and also, I mean, this was the time before computers or anything. So it was literally typing it out on an old battered typewriter. And so I'm sure if you go back now, there's loads and loads of errors. You know, like with a computer, you can just, oh, I've spelt that wrong. You know, even the computer will tell you you spelt it wrong and correct it for you. So, you know, you got all stuff like that now. So back then it was very much, you know, if you type something out and went back to read it again and there's an error, you just left it there because it would take too much time to type everything out again. Yeah, so I mean, looking back at them, they're not terrible, but they're probably a lot more scruffy than what I do nowadays. So, yeah. But I mean, even going back to what's normally referred to as the first punk fanzine, Sniffing Glue, I think the first issue of that, you know, some of it was actually handwritten. So, you know, technology has definitely made fanzines a lot more tidy.
Yeah, if not more charming, though. I mean, there's something to those mistakes, and
oh yeah,
the handwritten aesthetic is a great tradition in the punk fanzine world.
Yeah, definitely. The thing with fanzines is, I mean, so many people, you know, if you sell them at a concert, say, people get back in touch with you or see you at the next concert you went at, and they say, oh yeah, I read all of that. You know, on the way home, I was reading this. And they'll read interviews with people they've never heard of, or maybe bands that they don't particularly like, just to find out what they're about. And sometimes it changes their minds. So I think that's a good thing with fanzines.
Yeah, and there's... That's something unique about the format of Fear and Loathing. I don't know if you stick to this structure as much in recent issues, but in the past, the structure of each issue would just be this one long, unbroken kind of diary of your musical adventures for the past few months. You'd move between like a show review, and then a band interview. It was kind of a seamless thing. We would hear about friends of yours that you met along the way, mundane kind of details of your life, but none of it is dull. It's just like this very immersive read. And you end up reading about bands that you're not particularly interested in, but you become interested in. So I'm curious, where did you get this idea?
Right. I think the first one or two were a bit more, not really like that. They were more sort of structured, I suppose. I started doing it as a kind of diary format, you know, so like you said, it would go from, I'd be at a concert, then, you know, I'd do an interview there, maybe then there'd be the next concert and then the next or whatever. It just seemed an interesting way to do that at the time. I mean, I still kind of do that, although it's more, you know, I set things apart separately now so that, you know, there'll be a couple of pages worth of gig reviews. And then if I do an interview, that will be in its place as and when it happened next to the gigs that I would go and see either before or after it. So it's still in a kind of diary format, but a bit more, if you actually go in there, it's a bit easier to find things now, I think. Yeah, it just seemed like an interesting way to do it. And people tended to like it because they'd say, oh, yeah, I went to that concert. Yeah, I know exactly what you were meaning about, you know, the bouncers there were pain in the arse, or the bar prices were too expensive, or things like that. So you put little details in there and it helps people to relate to it because, you know, it gives them a chance to think, well, yeah, I've been to gigs like that. I know exactly what you mean. It just kind of puts it in a more sort of down-to-earth perspective, I think.
It feels a bit novelistic and has, you know, some of the appeal of like personal zines. Which I know is kind of a dirty word in some of our circles, but it doesn't have a lot of the squeamish personal stuff, but it's still, it's all about you. It's just your experience. And also it's with a traditional broken up fanzine, it's easy to skip the bands you're not wild about, but with this format, you're much more likely to read the whole thing because it's just one long, seamless piece.
Yeah, yeah. And I think nowadays, you know, I normally do 2, maybe 3 issues a year if I'm lucky. But yeah, I think people can look at it and think, well, you know, especially people in London, you know, obviously I know quite a lot of people that go to the same sort of concerts and whatever, so people will like read it and like, oh yeah, I was at that one with you, I was at this one, and it kind of gives them a chance to get into it and know what was happening at the time as well as the concert, because sometimes you need to, you know, there have been occasions where I've been to a concert and I haven't enjoyed it, but the reasons why I haven't enjoyed it is because I've just been having a really bad day, and you know, whoever I would have seen that evening, it just wouldn't have worked because I just wasn't in the mood for it. So it's kind of, you know, if you say, oh, I didn't enjoy such and such a band, if people know there's a reason why you didn't enjoy it, you know, maybe they won't take offense if I've just said I didn't enjoy their favorite band or something like that.
That's neat.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just a way of putting everything into context, I suppose. Yeah.
It also just feels very personal because it's virtually all written by you, I think. Yeah. Were you ever tempted to make it like a community fanzine and solicit contributions from friends?
Not really.
I think it would change the dynamic a lot. Yeah, I think it would lose something if you did.
Yeah, I've just always preferred writing it for myself. I think it's a case of that way, if someone gets upset about something you've written, not that that happens very often at all, really, but if someone, you know, takes offense at something you've written, then at least it's like, okay, I wrote it, you know, have a go at me. But there was an occasion with Fear and Loathing Grim Humor, where Richard had written something scathing about some band, and of course it was me that actually bumped into them at a concert somewhere, and they started having a go at me, and it's like, well, yeah, but don't talk to me. I didn't write that. I quite like your band, you know. So, yeah, the more people are involved, the more awkward it can get at times, I think. So that's why I started out just doing it myself. And, you know, ever since then, I've just got into the habit, and that's always the way I've done it. So, yeah,
we were talking about eclecticism and open-mindedness in terms of musical coverage with Grim Humor. And I think the same holds for Fear and Loathing as well. I was flipping through some of the earlier issues I have, and I see interviews with like Devo, Swans, Dickies, Cop Shoot Cop, Lagwagon, Green Day, Shellac, Fetus, Flipper. It's not your traditional, quote, punk fanzine. It's really, like, there's a ton of variety in there, isn't there?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the more important things, because you get too many people who just stick to one or two things that they like, and they're just not interested in listening to anything else. You know, when you go home to listen to a record, it's great to have like a variety of things you can listen to. You know, say something from the 60s through to something that's only come out last month or something like that. I think I'd get myself, I'd get very, very bored if I only had two or three albums to listen to, or two or three bands that I'd listen to, because it's not special if you're only listening to one thing all the time. It's like people who say they're into, you know, extreme, well, at the moment, I suppose it's like black metal, you know, people who are into black metal, you know, I only like the extreme stuff. And so, well, if that's the only thing that you listen to, it's not extreme anymore. It's your mainstream, you know, because you're not listening to anything else. You know, if you're going to listen to black metal, if you're going to really appreciate it, you also have to listen to something like, you know, an acoustic album or something like the Cocteau Twins, you know, so that you get the balance between the two things. Then it's extreme. But if it's all you listen to, it becomes your new mainstream, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's nothing to sort of compare it with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I wonder, do you have any musical blind spots? Are there things that you're like, yeah, that's not really for me, not my cup of tea, like jazz, electronic? Are there things that just don't resonate with you?
I mean, I tend to think that any kind of musical genre, you'll always find something good there. So it tends to be, you know, oh, I don't like that style of music. But what that really means is I haven't heard something in that style of music that I like yet. But I tend to think there's stuff there. I mean, when was this be? In the 90s, I think, you know, when the whole big sort of rave dance movement was going. And a lot of that was just, I mean, to me, it was just dull music. It wasn't something that you'd actually want to listen to. But having said that, there were one or two records that came out, which I thought were really interesting, really good, exciting music. As a whole, I was never into that kind of rave thing. It just didn't appeal to me. But yeah, I mean, you find out that there are a few artists using it to do something really exciting or interesting. So I tend to keep myself open to music, but, you know, obviously there's going to be bits and pieces along the line that for one reason or another, you just don't get into it.
Your interviews have a lot of substance, Andy. You've been doing this for years, since 1983. What are some best practices you've learned?
Tends to help if you've got a fairly good knowledge of what the band or, you know, musician has been doing, because there's a lot of it, you know, a lot of things tend to be because there's something in their background that's interesting and they've kind of developed from that point. So if you go along and try to interview someone and you don't already know anything about them, it can go pretty poorly, because, you know, they won't get enthusiastic about it. It's kind of like, if you can get someone to talk about what they want to talk about, then they'll really open up and, you know, let you know what they're thinking or what they're doing or whatever. And especially now, because of the internet, you know, there's really no excuse for like going along and interviewing someone and not knowing their background, because you can find, you know, general stuff. But then you've got to try and get them to talk about it, about what they're actually doing and why they're doing it. And that tends to be the more interesting thing, I think.
Do you always prefer in-person interviews?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, telephone interviews aren't that bad. Written interviews, you know, if you do an interview by email, I mean, once in a while, it has to be done because there's no other way you can do it.
Sure.
But It does tend to be, when it's a written interview, it just becomes question, answer, question, answer. And it's a bit sort of flat. Whereas, you know, I prefer to do an interview more like a general conversation, like, well, kind of like what we're doing here. This is much better, I think, a better way of doing it, because you're actually conversing with the person rather than, you know, just answering written questions or something like that. Mm-hmm. But face-to-face is usually better, because you can, you know, you can get a better connection with the person you're talking to. I think that's the main thing.
Do you know, kind of off the top of your head, which band or musician you've interviewed the most? I know there's certain ones who've featured in multiple issues of Fear and Loathing. Mm-hmm. And I'm also curious, how do you manage to keep it fresh each time?
I mean, there's quite often bands that I will only interview once, and then after that, there's not really much more I could ask them.
Yeah.
So it does tend to be bands that are ongoing and they're still active and they're still doing something interesting. And I'll go and interview them because, say, they've got a new album out that I really like and I want to talk about that, or they're doing something that I'm really interested in and I can talk to them about that. I don't like, you know, just repeating questions that I've already asked them in the past. So, you know, there's not much point in doing that. So, yeah, I think that's the thing. It depends on the subject. If they've got something worth talking about, then, you know, I'm happy to interview them. I mean, Buzzcocks, I interviewed them a few times. And obviously with them, there was like the two aspects, because there was Steve Diggle, who I've interviewed a couple of times, and then Pete Shelley, who I've interviewed. I think I've only interviewed him once. But, and, you know, their kind of approach to the band was almost opposite. You know, Steve is more the kind of rock and roll side of things, whereas Pete's approach to their music was more from a kind of eclectic, shall we say, arty sort of point of view. Mm-hmm. So although they were, you know, combining together to make this, you know, some great records and whatever, they were actually doing it from two different angles, and I think that's what kept Buzzcocks pretty interesting in the long run. So yeah, I mean, with bands like that, you know, there's always something interesting you can talk to them about, you know, whereas other bands, you know, it's interesting to talk to them once and get, you know, their background and their story and whatever, but once you've done that, there isn't really going to be that much more you could talk to them about, and unless they come up and do something outstanding that nobody expected, you know.
I wonder, have any interviews gone sideways or just weren't usable because the person wasn't engaged or responsive? Have you run into that before?
Yeah, although I've got to say, not very often. Most people, you know, if they agree to do an interview, they're happy to do it. I mean, you tend to find this with people who are, you know, quite successful people. They get surrounded by all these different, like, music agents or record labels or whatever, saying, oh, no, you can't speak to them, you can't do that. No, they wouldn't want to interview, they wouldn't want to do it for a mere fanzine sort of thing. But when you actually meet these people, they're usually incredibly down to earth and are perfectly happy to talk about their music or whatever. And it's just getting to talk to them in the first place, which can be a real pain in the arse. But there was one band from years ago that I interviewed and they were just not interested, you know, and it was, you know, it wasn't, you'd think a band who were just about to put out their first album would want to tell people about it. And, you know, I could hardly get more than a yes or no answer from any of them. So that was kind of disappointing. One time, I mean, this is going back to Grim Humour, so it would have been about 1984-85, I interviewed Nick Cave. It was a very, very strange evening, because again, I turned up early at the venue he was playing and managed to sneak in backstage. He was just finishing the sound check, so I got to speak to him as he finished that. And he says, oh, yeah, sure, yeah, I've just got to go off. I've got a couple of things to do, but I'll be back here by 9, and I'm not on stage until 10. So come backstage at 9 o'clock. I'll tell my manager that you're coming, and I'll talk to you then. So I thought, great, you know, that was all right. By the time he turned up, his whole mood and attitude had changed, and he was just really, you know, I was asking him questions about his latest album and stuff like this, and he just didn't want to say anything. So yeah, that was really disappointing, because at that point I really liked The Birthday Party, and I really liked the first couple of solo albums he did. So to end up like talking to him like that, and him being a bit of a pain in the arse, so I'll say. It was just really disappointing, you know. And
That would be a bummer. I'm glad. Yeah. It sounds like it was in the minority for sure, though.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, that very, very rarely happens. In fact, you know, I could probably, you know, maybe that's happened 3 or 4 times over the years. But yeah, I mean, that was particularly the worst one, because it was something that I was really looking forward to doing, and it kind of went pear shaped. So yeah. It was only a couple of weeks after that he got busted for possession of a certain substance.
Oh. So
that may have explained why his attitude changed in the couple of hours between when I first saw him and later on. But, you know.
Could be.
Please put that down as allegedly. Because I don't know for sure, but, seeing what happened later on, that may be the reason. I don't know, but yeah.
I wonder, are there, you've interviewed so many people, anybody that is on your interview bucket list that you haven't chatted with yet?
I suppose the one person I've always wanted, well, for most of the time I've wanted to interview, is probably Iggy Pop. I mean, the thing is with him is everybody said, well, if you actually get to meet him, he'll be perfectly happy to do an interview. He's a great guy. And I did meet him once very briefly, and he did seem like a really nice guy, you know, but there was no chance of an interview at that point because he was heading off somewhere else. But I'd like to interview him. That would be interesting, because there's a lot of stuff that he's done over the years that he never, ever gets asked about nowadays. I mean, you see him being interviewed on TV, and, you know, you can kind of look at his face and think he's thinking, you know, oh God, not the same question again. Oh, Iggy, why do you take your shirt off? Oh, for fuck's sake. Is that the most interesting thing you can come up with? You know,
but how do you keep your trim figure at your age? Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so, so predictable. But, you know, there's loads of stuff that I'd like to talk to him about, but I doubt if I ever get the chance. But who knows? I'll still go for it. But apart from that, bands like Black Sabbath, that would be great to interview them. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of people that you can think about, but, you know, I don't really take it too seriously because, you know, the chances of actually getting an interview with them are so slim anyway. Or you just wouldn't be able to get in touch with them in the first place. So that's a bit sort of, it can be a bit irritating at points, but, you know, you see someone else doing an interview and thinking, I could have done something a lot better than that. So, I mean, most of the people I want to interview, I've managed one way or another, which is kind of lucky that, you know, I've always been into bands who aren't particularly commercially successful, because smaller bands are always going to be easier to contact and probably more enthusiastic about talking about their music. So, yeah.
Just a few more questions. I'd love to hear a bit about kind of the nuts and bolts distribution stuff about the fanzine. How do you get Fear and Loathing out there, and how has that changed over time?
It has definitely changed, because it used to be, you know, before the internet, you know, you could only print the thing up. So you actually had a physical copy and you'd have to take it to places, you know, I mean, a lot of them were, you know, you take a bag to a concert and just sell them to people at the concert, which was, that's not a bad way of doing it, but it means that every time you go to a concert, you've got to carry a bag full of magazines with you. The things that have changed, though, because there used to be, particularly in London, there used to be lots of shops, like independent shops. You know, you could take a fanzine into them and they take it in the shop on a sort of sale or return basis. And, you know, they would basically sell the fanzines for you. Unfortunately, over the past 10, 20 years, a lot of those shops have, you know, they've gone. They're not there anymore. I mean, I used to go down to, I don't know if you're familiar with London.
No, unfortunately.
Well, Portobello Road in West London. If you went down to the bottom end of Portobello Road, there was a whole load of different record shops, and they would all take copies of the fanzine for you, say 10 or 20 copies. And then you'd go back, you know, a month or two later, and they'd give you the money for them, which was, you know, really easy way of getting it there, because, you know, the people who were going in to buy records for themselves were also, you know, wanted to know what other bands were happening. So they pick up fanzines to try and check out what else was going on. And there was a couple of bookshops as well. Compendium in Camden was a really good one. But again, that's gone now. So really, there's only, I'm just trying to think, really, there's only two shops left in London that will sell fanzines now. So it's really, really limited the amount you can sell. On top of that, at the same time, postal costs now are, well, you got the fanzine that I sent over to you. You know, the postal costs are like two or three times the cost of the fanzine itself. So people aren't, a lot of people just aren't going to buy it because the postal costs put them off. That was probably the main reason why I started doing the website version of it, because going back to the 80s and 90s, you know, I always had, not huge amounts, but I'd always have people who would buy copies from, you know, America or Europe or whatever. But, you know, gradually that had fallen off because of the postal costs getting so much. So I decided to do a website because I thought, well, at least if I put everything on the internet, people can still get to read the interviews rather than people not getting to read the interviews because they can't find the magazine anywhere. So yeah, I started doing that, and that's had, you know, quite a successful response. Plus also I can still do a small amount of the fanzines, you know, say, like I said earlier, like every 6 months or so, you know, once I've got enough material, I can like print it off from the internet and put it in a fanzine, proper fanzine format. And, you know, I mean, I can sell like a couple of hundred copies quite easily without, you know, too much hassle. And there's still quite a lot of people who actually prefer the physical magazine format. That's the way I do it now, balance it between, you know, doing it on the internet and also doing a real fanzine.
Do you hear from readers very much, Andy?
Yeah, and particularly because of the internet version, you know, people can get in touch from the most bizarre places. I mean, a little while back, I got an email from a band based in Nepal, and they're playing like hardcore punk. And you're thinking, hardcore punk in Nepal? What the? It's a sort of like the last place you'd expect there to be any kind of rock music, really. But obviously, it means something to them. So, you know, it's great finding out that this stuff still goes on around the world in different places. And in some places, it's actually really important because they may have like an oppressive government or something. So when they're singing their lyrics, they really mean it because they could get arrested for it, you know. But apart from that, yeah, I mean, I do get contacted from people all over the place, really. It's quite interesting to see, to come across people who've actually read the magazine in some place halfway around the world from me.
You're up to issue 86 now, which has to be some kind of music fanzine record. And how far do you hope to take it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll just carry on. If there's something interesting that I want to write about, then I'll just carry on doing it. I mean, there's no sort of like cutoff point. I mean, one of the things I say to people sometimes, it's the great thing about doing your own fanzine, is because if you get into a position where you want to take 6 months off and do nothing, you can do that. And no one else is going to tell you, oh, but you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Yeah, you can take a break and then come back to it, or, you know, just carry on if you're happy with carrying on. So as long as there's stuff there that I still want to cover, then I'll carry on doing it.
And friends, that is our show. Thank you so much to Andy for taking the time to chat. If there were such a thing as a fanzine hall of fame, I would certainly put his name forward very early on. Please do check out fearandloathingfanzine.com online. connect with Andy about ordering his latest issue. At the time of recording, it is number 86 and features quality chats with The Sweet, Undertones, Really Red, and much more. Andy also updates the website regularly with online exclusive content, and there is currently up a really cool chat with David Thomas of Père Ubu fame. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review or rating, telling a friend. Thank you so much. Until next time.